You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Matthew Arsenovich, PhD candidate at Northwestern University, studying Russian literature and film.
And I'm Cameron Lana, an open-minded thinker, here to tell you that the podcast is taking a new turn. You may have been expecting an office hours episode, and just I'd like you to know the date, not April 1st. This is truly where we're taking the podcast. We decided that a scholarly engagement with literature is maybe a little boring, a little droll.
Outmoded, really.
Yeah, exactly. Well, then we looked at some kind of reactionary book people online, and they got tons of followers, and it seems like they're making good money, and we decided we should do that because it looks like they're putting no effort into it. And so today what we're actually doing in the spirit of openness is that we are going to be reviewing one such online reactionary book person named Jash Dolani, who also goes by the name Old Books Guy on Twitter, and seeing what lessons there are for us to learn as we make this rightward shift. I'm really excited for this. I think this is going to be super useful.
Well, you say rightward, I say forward, since this is the future. Or is it backwards, because we're going to the past for some of these ideas.
That's right. What we're doing today is we are covering Jash Dolani's book, Hit Reverse, called subtitle New Ideas from Old Book. Yeah. Well, I should say Old Book. I think there's only one book in here. And this is from
Cameron. Please keep your mind open.
Which is introduced by, okay, this is on pinned on Jash's Twitter. It is time. 3 years of research, 17,000 tweets, and hundreds of old books later, I present to you Hit Reverse. My absolute best threads and a lot of new writing packed into 64 chapters, 244 pages, 750 insights, and then an order link.
Where is the order on? Where do you buy
it? It's on gumroad.com, which I'm not familiar with.
I haven't heard of that publisher.
I'm pretty certain this is like itch.io for books.
No, I'm playing. I know what Gumroad is.
Oh, what is Gumroad?
It's not where books should be sold.
Oh, awesome. That's good.
Gumroad is like where you sell, like, I don't know, like bad investment courses, I think.
That's basically what this book is, so.
Open mind, please.
Open mind. Sorry. That's right. Well, yes. So, Jash is someone.
I was excited. 3 years of research is a long time. That's like, I mean, people write a dissertation in 3 years. That's good pace.
I know. Well, it's a little undercut by the fact that he leads with 17,000 tweets and not with actually reading books for this. But I mean, hey, right. What do I know?
I'm confused if it's the amount of tweets he's read or the amount of tweets that he's made.
He's made 18,000 tweets, so I'm assuming that is a number.
Also, why does he still call them tweets when we all know that Elon prefers us to call them posts?
Well, this Jash Dolani is, I would bet, is a big believer in dead naming, so that's not surprising to me. Also, this is definitely not 17,000 posts, because you should see if you search like any given tweet on this man's account, he's already posted the same tweet, every single tweet, like five or six times at the very least. Some of his bangers, he's
got
total, up
to like
15.
It says he has 18,200 posts, not tweets, posts.
Posts, sorry, yes, excuse me.
Why use the brand terminology worth, I don't know, billions of dollars that's been built up over decades?
I know.
When you could go with the far, far superior post.
Yeah. So Jash Dolani is someone we've clowned on a little bit on Twitter before. We decided, hey, what if we got into a real
what happened on Twitter that we felt the need to that really got our attention?
He posted this. This was like, I think probably last December. He posted this list full of good art versus bad art, and as you might imagine, it's complete. It's not a good idea. It's not a helpful or useful way of looking at art, and frankly,
is what you would say if you didn't have an open
that's
mind.
Right. That's what the naysayers would say, and obviously we're not naysayers. We're believers in Jash and Jash's mission. Mm-hmm. But it was, if you were a naysayer, the language bordering on fascistic, I would say. I usually try not to like apply that, but when your whole thing is about how art has to be, is like it's man's like moral duty to make beautiful art, but beautiful art only has to fit a specific small category of moral enlightenment, and not really challenging what you already thought, just kind of reinforcing how you already think, as long as it's how you already think is kind of reactionary.
Yeah, it was a fantastic tweet.
The most annoying people in the world love to say there is not objective difference between good art and bad art. So I made a list of 15. Let me see if I can... It's stuff like, number one, emotional effect. Good art improves mood. Bad art makes you feel weird. Okay, sure. Mental effect. Good art clarifies the mind. Well, bad art confuses the mind.
I don't like to be challenged personally. Yeah. So that's good.
Right. Okay, here's a good one. I like this. Instinct knows. It's a weird difference. Good art is instinctively recognized as art, whereas bad art is instinctively recognized as a scam.
Right. Well, I think if it was, then you wouldn't need to make the post if it was so instinctual.
Yeah, I think if I had to guess, I would say this is probably, you know, if you've been on social media, there's like the same post that's been going around for a billion years about someone posts of the banana posted like taped to the wall, or that toilet installation is like, can you believe this is what modern art is? And I'm like, all the pieces of art they're posting are decades to up to 100 years old. Which makes this exhausting.
Right.
But they always say the same thing because they've got no idea what art is and they don't engage with any art. I'm like fairly certain that's what he means by this. I like
probably.
If bad art's instinctively recognized as a scam, why, like you say, why would you ever need to warn about it?
But fortunately, we are, just in case your instincts haven't been trained. You don't have the hardened artistic muscle that we have.
Yeah, right. Here's another one. Good GPS or bad GPS? Good art is a good map. Bad art is a malevolently bad map.
Yeah, no, that's true.
It's a banger.
I feel like, here's the thing, is if you're going to do like a 1 to 10, there's like 10 points on this, right?
Right.
I feel like I would have led with a few of the stronger ones, because this is clearly like, he probably had like 3 or 4, but he was like, I need to get to 10 for the Twitter thread.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the root of this is just I'm envious that our tweets don't do as well.
Right.
You know how much time we put into making Magnitogorsk art?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a big deal for us to be representing the Magnitogorsk Tourism Board in America.
Well, yeah, and that's good art. So yeah. Obviously it doesn't generate the kind of controversy that bad art would.
Yeah, I mean, I think definitionally any art that leads you to Magnitogorsk is a good map.
yeah, that's what I put in my GPS. My GPS only goes to Magnitogorsk. It's a real problem.
If you get down to it, I think down towards the bottom, that's where the language starts to get kind of fascistic, where values, it's like values, good art hints at forgotten values, bad art mocks the concept of values, which is just rephrased this eternal belly aching about postmodernism. Or Hall of Fame, join or burn. Good art wishes to be canonic, bad art wishes to destroy the canon.
Fundamentally untrue.
Of course, all good art has always been super accepted. War and Peace famously came out and everyone was like, yeah, this is exactly how we write novels and we love it for that. That's what we all know about War and Peace. So that's the kind of stuff. I don't know. Do you have any choice tweet? I mean, let's get a couple other good ones from Josh's Twitter account. Just to give you an idea of who this guy is. You told me right before we started recording, he had a real banger today.
Yeah, I don't know where did I put it? Sorry, I always get distracted scrolling through his Twitter. Like, I can feel my blood pressure rising.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Can I join mine if it's the DEI one?
Oh, please. Yeah, that's what I was looking for.
Of course, yeah, he's really big on like, I'm looking to old books for new knowledge, but coincidentally, everything he's learning from the old books is exactly in step with every other reactionary online, which is, really shows you the testament of reactionary beliefs that everything they read tells them exactly what is on the issue on their plate right now. It's pretty amazing, real testament.
What issue is
DEI mentions in earning calls dropped by 75%. Great, but slave morality will be back soon enough under a different moniker, a different acronym, a different mask. The coalition of the inept and resentful is forever ramming at the fortress of civilization. That will never change.
True.
The most canceled woman in the world, Camille Paglia. I wish she was canceled so I could stop having to hear about her.
What I like is every one of these tweets ends with a Pepe meme. And so I'm curious, like, when he says he spent 3 years of research writing the book, wow, like, was part of the research doing the Pepe memes? Or was it photoshopping, like, the red crypto eyes onto historical figures.
He spent like 3 years, I have to imagine, arguing on, I don't remember which board is the literature board on 4chan, and I have to assume mostly getting run out of there by them, and that's why he tweets so much.
Yeah, that probably makes sense.
Oh, here, okay, hold on. I didn't read this. I know I said he was like vaguely fascist coded, but I just scrolled down on his timeline today.
Not vague.
Not yet, really. Pretty well. Here's the thing: is that he was just using a lot of fascistic language. But I just saw this tweet. You can ignore symbols, but your enemies will not. Communists did not. Dot dot dot. After taking power, the first thing communists did was invert the meaning of three traditional symbols. Julius Evola explains in a 1928 essay the inversion of symbols. Julius Evola is a famous member of the Italian fascist movement.
Okay, this is actually a really good tweet that I wanted to talk about, like why, I didn't know if we're going to fit into the episode, but why specifically this Twitter discourse is so, so damaging. It's just that like there was so much going on in the 1920s that has to do with symbol, and he really conflates like... He conflates symbols and symbolism and lowercase s symbol, capital S symbol. He doesn't really understand what's going on in the things he's writing about, which is a theme that we're going to be coming back to with pretty much everything in the book. It's well, I mean, you wouldn't be surprised to know that it's not particularly deep, but basically his analysis rests on like elementary school color theory, which I would maybe recommend going back to like art class if that's the kind of analysis you want to do, because it has no place in the analysis that he's trying to do. It's rough.
Yeah. So you might be asking yourself, as maybe you should start transitioning and talking about the book, but as we're kind of in this interlude, maybe you're asking, why are we covering this guy? And, you know, we thought, do we need to give this guy air? And then we realized he's got way more followers than us. We're not really giving him any air. And the other concern we have is like, is this unnecessarily mean? Are we just bullying someone? And then we realize this guy's an asshole. It doesn't matter. And here's the thing. I think there's this tendency that if you are, and we try to approach things in good faith to really sit down and understand someone's point of view and be like, all right, what can we work with here? This sort of point of view, there, it's a dime a dozen. It's not unique. It is made simply to make money. For the most part, and secondarily, you know, feel good about having the smart, good ideas. And there's no reason to take it seriously. So we're not going to, and we're here to relentlessly make fun of it because trust us, as soon as you read the first line of this book, you realize this man's an absolute idiot. And if I had written this book and I had to tell people it took me 3 months, I would be so embarrassed, let alone 3 years to produce this dog shit.
Yeah, not great, I wouldn't say. I really wouldn't say. Not to mention most of it is repurposed tweets.
Yeah, it's literally all repurposed. I think there's some... We'll get into it. I think we're going to be jumping around. So, full disclosure, we've read like a little bit of this book, but we thought it would be funnier for us to get into like... for you to come along on this ride with us. So we've seen a little bit of this, but we really don't fully know what we're getting into, other than the few chapters we read, which are... just so perfectly bad.
You know what's hilarious, though, is that most of the books on the show, publishers will send to us. A lot of the interviews, whatever, they'll send us review copies. Very nice, very fortunate. This is one of the few books we actually had to pay for on the show. One, because I wasn't going to degrade myself to ask for a review copy. I don't think Gumroad does review copies. I just find that intensely funny. But this is basically a very small version of the... large scale, like I would say, like pseudo academic grifting that is very common with like this like neoconservative element. It starts from Jordan Peterson. Oh, I mean, it starts, you know, before this probably, but you know, this sort of Jordan Peterson and his Peterson University or whatever, just absolute crap that he's shoveling. I mean, I don't know why you would take a class with a man who isn't even respected in his own field. It's like embarrassing. Let alone not respected in any field that he tries to work in.
Yeah.
And this is like a small version of that. So where Peterson's trying to sell you, I don't know, thousands of dollars of university courses, this is just a $5 Gumroad book. But it's the same exact thing. It's just, you know, harvesting, you know, basically online rage and just lonely, disaffected men into... this sort of like pseudo self-help program that is not going to work.
Yeah.
It's so infuriating for me to see. It just, yeah, makes me like legitimately upset that this is where people are going to take advice from.
And the thing is that I've run into people who in my own life who I thought were like, seemed intelligent. And then they'd send me like a Jordan Peterson video and like, what do you think of this? I'd be like, oh God. And then I'd watch it. It wouldn't even be, I don't know if Jordan Peterson has any good clips, but it would usually be something that was like, if you know anything about anything, it's ridiculous. It was, I think the one that stands out was when he was like, oh, the feminists and the postmodernists are actually secretly Marxists, which believe me, brother, that's not a secret. That's the Marxist wings of both of those disciplines will let you know. that they are, and that they're trying to destroy Western society, and it's all a big secret conspiracy that they've been behind the scenes of, and I don't know what to tell you. They're all grad students in school, and their professors don't even read their work, let alone anyone else. I don't know what you think is going on here, but
you shouldn't be scared of like the grad students, because like if we were any good at anything, we'd learn how to get paid better. So you know, like leave us alone.
Right,
leave us alone.
They have enough problems. And then Jordan Peterson goes like, "What's my advice?" And it's stuff like clean your room, get better at it. And then you have people who are like you say, like really disaffected young men who have unfortunately never been taught any better, who are like, "This is revolutionary thinking."
Yeah, the thing that I can't do with Jordan Peterson for me is the fact that he always sounds like, you know, like when you take a bite of a really crumbly bread and maybe some of it gets stuck in your throat. He constantly sounds like that. And I don't like it.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, speaking of crumbs that are going to get stuck in our throat, let's go to the introduction. Let's read. What is...
Sure. We're already like 20 minutes into this.
Well, you know, this is just chat episode. Okay. So let me read to you the opening lines of Hit Reverse. New ideas from old books. And the first thing you might notice as you go through the table of contents is most of these, each chapter is about a book, theoretically. And most of them you'll notice are
what
not
the title?
Actually books.
What's the title of the introduction?
The title of the introduction is The Return Manifesto.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll just keep that in mind because you can see from the get-go, no attention to literary form. It's not a manifesto, but all right, I'll set that aside.
This is barely even an introduction.
No.
It reads, quote, "We read old books not because we are old or because we are bookish, but because we are young and because we want to shape the future instead of sleepwalking through it. Books are like memories. Time spares no trivial memory or book. Let the years pass and only the significant ones remain." That's not true. It's just the ones that remain, and sometimes significant ones tend to come around better. The ones that mean something. That's such an awful way of thinking. If it still exists, it must be good.
Right.
The ones that still have something to teach you. The ones that hold the answers to questions you've not fully articulated yet. That starts talking about fear, mostly just quoting from G.K. Chesterton.
Let's just say there's a lot of quotes that are not engaged with. I'm not really sure how they even relate.
Yep. Yep. Let's see. If you are a true progressive in the true sense of the word, if you want to make real progress, you should simply answer the knock, open the door. No meaningful future can be created without acknowledging the sublime achievements and terrifying warnings of the past. Nietzsche once wrote that the man who needs to take a big leap forward first needs to walk 10 steps back. Let us walk then, for the abyss is big and we'll need all the momentum we can get.
I thought 10 and under are supposed to be spelled out. This is numerical 10, should be T-E-N, 10.
It depends on what style guide you're. I mean, for if
mine,
I don't think this he's doing this. I think he's just doing whatever. But if he's writing according to AP style guide, that'd be correct.
Yeah, take that.
Take that. You're writing an AP style guide.
Style guided,
the greatest condemnation you can make of him. All right, let's take a round. Look at some of these books. I love. Okay, here we go. This is from part one, The Truth About Human Nature. The chapter is titled "Digging into Dostoevsky's Heart," and you think, "Great, what Dostoevsky novel are we going to cover?" None of them. It's letters of Fyodor Dostoevsky.
Right. Well, because it's about old books, right? And Dostoevsky, you know, famously wrote a lot of famous books, but they're really long. So maybe I'll just cherry pick a letter. These are also like, this book has the margins of an undergraduate essay when they're like, no, I had the page count, right?
Well, see.
Like, yeah, but you're like thousands of words off.
It's the only way to get to 244 pages.
Yeah. Well, so why does he choose to do, what is his reasoning for doing letters and not books?
Let's see, hold on. Dostoevsky believe life is only possible when you have a philosophical North Star you swear by. Okay, just a bunch of quotes from Dostoevsky. If you have scorn for everything...
Not cited.
Not cited. Oh, yeah. None of these things are cited.
Nothing cited.
Let's see. If you have scorn for everything, you have no center of gravity. Let's see. In his essay against environmental determinism, Dostoevsky writes the doctrine... Okay, he's basically Dostoevsky being mad about Chernyshevsky. In another letter, Dostoevsky revealed the mystery one to solve. Man is a mystery. If you spend your life trying to puzzle it out, then do not say you have wasted your life. I occupy myself with this mystery because I want to be a man. Then what does he say about it? He does say things about what man is, Jash. What if we got to that?
No.
Dostoevsky. I really got to emphasize now that we're going through this. It is just an introduction, like a one-sentence introduction to a paragraph, and then just quoting from a letter with no coherence beyond that, as far as I can tell.
Well, it's not even a full sentence. It's like the lead-in. Like, this man's never heard of sandwiching quotes. If I got this, straight up, if I got this from an undergrad, I'm not even sure I would give him credit. And now, my teaching reviews do sometimes say that I'm a hard grader, but, you know.
Right.
This you can see right here why it's warranted.
Oh, here, this is an awesome paragraph. Dostoevsky lists all important questions that societies must ask. Great. I would love to know what we're actually talking about here. Whom can we now consider our best people? Most importantly, where shall we find them? Who will take this responsibility for proclaiming them the best, and on what basis? Does someone need to take this responsibility? Very Dostoevsky question ask. And then Jash comes back in with, but today our political systems worship at the altar of equality and try to weasel their way out of these questions. I'm sure that's what Dostoevsky meant.
I think that there's something... Yeah. Maybe, I don't know. There's a... Dostoevsky is definitely a tricky one, I would say.
Yeah.
But there's a reason why this type of person is attracted to Dostoevsky, and it's no secret on that. But there's this part that I just love about all of this, which is deep within this, not even that deep because there's no depth, but within this web of people on Twitter that so yearns for this nostalgic, invented past, they really, what they... deep down want is to be like the king of some country. They really want to be, or they want to be like some aristocratic vassal, basically. Not realizing that there was like 10 people that have the level of power and wealth that they would have wanted to have at that
right.
time. Like most of these people that want to go back to an aristocracy, like you would have been like a slave or a serf, or like you would have been living in a straw hut. You wouldn't have time to be contemplating art. You'd be out in the field farming.
And I think Tolstoy puts forth, maybe you should be, maybe that's better, maybe based on this example is bad.
That's a really good point from an old book that we should take. maybe not everyone needs to be reading.
Maybe none of us should be reading.
More people should be farming, gardening, not talking to each other online.
Yeah. I also, okay, I was just like, every paragraph, you can see this is how little cohesion this is. This is the introduction line to the quote that you just left Dostoevsky to their ask, from one to the next. But Dostoevsky only needed three things. Next paragraph. But Dostoevsky warned against introversion. Next paragraph. Do we possess talent or does talent possess us? Next paragraph. Dostoevsky and the measure of great art. You can really tell this was a Twitter thread.
Well, that is so the thing is we've completely, and I'm going to sound like an old boomer and just like the worst kind of professor, but we've really lost our ability to clearly articulate points and write in a sort of understandable form. Like it's so funny for someone who complains, Jash being the one who's complaining about all of this, he's perpetrating these exact things that he's disliking, and it's intensely amusing for me.
Yeah.
But again, at the same time, very frustrating because there are so many people like cheering him on in the comments that make me wonder if he's like comment botting his own threads, because for real, like not all of these are winners even within their realm.
I just don't think they know anything about what he doesn't know anything about what he's writing about, and they don't either, because he gets really into like weird reactionaries. He is like, oh, let me tell you all about I read about them, except for Nietzsche. He does seem to write a lot about Nietzsche, and I'll exclude Nietzsche from that. Stay away from my boy. But then he'll do, without irony, post about the lessons of Tolstoy, where he'll just quote some like weird like pop essay about it, and then without any irony followed up with, anyway, so here's why Napoleon was the pinnacle of Western civilization.
Yeah. I did see the Napoleon Stan tweet.
The one, there are dozens, dozens upon dozens of this, of him really simping for Napoleon.
Yeah, there are. I cut you off when you were talking about this, but my real thing that I think is hilarious for the premise of the book is, yeah, the fact that he's not really talking about books. Just, all right, maybe I'll talk about Solzhenitsyn's Harvard commencement speech, right. Not any of his books, which it's just clear he didn't want to read the books. It's very undergrad essay coded, and I really like that.
Here's a feather in the cap of your point. In the next chapter, does beauty matter when the bombs start falling? Which I think C.S. Lewis, the creator of Narnia, addressed a crowd of Oxford students in 1939. And this is hard to say because it's learning in wartime. It's hard for me to say whether this is a book or whether we're about to be coming from this speech, because he doesn't cite anything. So I have no idea what any of the following quotes are from, if that is. I think this is just a commencement speech that he's quoting from.
What I really love though is like this sort of how should I put it? This sort of new like conservative intellectual milieu. It's so didactic. They don't want to be argued with. They don't want to be challenged at all, despite what they will say. And you can see it in the form of this so-called book because of the fact that literally nothing is cited. There's no way to go back and check what he's saying. He just wants you to accept what he's saying at face value as if he's literally any authority on it, despite the fact that he refers to himself as an independent scholar and philosopher, which is laughable. That's stretching both terms to their utmost maximum. That's why it's on Gumroad. See, I take it too seriously. It frustrates me.
Yeah, I just love this. This is so good. Okay, so we were saying that I was reading it. This is awesome. So theoretically the premise of this chapter.
So I'm getting furious just reading it, and you're like, this is great. I love this. Jazz, you've won one fan here today.
I wish I could do what Jazz is doing.
He's got some points.
So theoretically the premise of this chapter is, does beauty matter when the bombs start falling? And we start off with. Second paragraph, to be concerned with truth, beauty, and culture as one nation's fight a war, is this the equivalent to fiddling while Rome burns? I'll give Jash credit here. This whole time I've been saying he's not talking about anything. This is at least something. But then after he poses that question, he doesn't have any personal viewpoints. He just goes at Lewis's reply. What is it? The war creates absolutely no new situation. It simply aggravates the permanent human condition, which then Jash cuts in with, the permanent human condition is endless strife, chaos, and pain. All right. C.S. Lewis,
go off.
Human life has always been lived on the edge of a precipice, yada, yada, yada. Therefore, if we waited for peace to create the art, this is Jash again. If we waited for peace to create art, the first cave painting would not have been made. There's always some imminent danger looking more important than culture. Okay, sure. That's a point. I'll give that to him. And then you're like, wait, why are there two more pages? And then we get to the Twitter thread where he just goes, C.S. Lewis considers the difference between insect life and human life, quote, next paragraph, C.S. Lewis fought in World War I. He saw that on the front line, soldiers didn't talk of the Allied cause or progress of the campaign. They're instead concerned with stories, myths, and fateful open-ended questions. Next chapter, C.S. Lewis on why ideas matter. You had a point, just a point. I'm not even going to evaluate the quality of the point. You had a point for three paragraphs, and that's great. And we get to the end of this chapter, and again, this is just after many more paragraphs of just introduction, C.S. Lewis quote, and then we get to bottom line in bold point, which, by the way, no other chapter, as far as I can tell, none that we've covered so far, have a bottom line. It would have been really nice if you kept that up of like, here's what you're supposed to learn from this chapter. But I guess if you did that, people would probably just read that, not the rest of your book. So bottom line, don't wait for spare time to know what you want to know and to chase what you want to chase. That's the point.
Real wisdom. Yeah, bestowed upon me. Thank you.
That's not, it's barely, it kind of relates to the point. Jesus, I mean, he almost held a point for three paragraphs, and that was apparently too tough for him.
You know what this, like, kind of reminds me of, what? Though? And I'm going to say this with a lot of preface, because I don't want it to be construed as saying they're in any way the same. Just a comment on sort of the form, because I think the only thing that this maybe does well is it is trying to address things that people are upset about, or issues that the person sees in modern life, trying to do it with some classics or whatever. It doesn't do that at all, but whatever. It reminds me of, so Gary Sloan Morrison wrote this book on Anna Karenina, Seeing More Wisely. I can't remember the exact title. And it's his reading of Anna Karenina, and it's written in a more like public-friendly way. It's not quite public scholarship, but it's, it's scholarship, and he's a good writer, so it's a pretty, all things considered, easy read, I would say, for that kind of book. At the end of the book, I think it was this book and not one of his ones on War and Peace, he has this sort of section that's like 100 lessons that Tolstoy can teach you for modern life. And it has like the same kind of approach, right? Now, the thing is, the problem with that, and this was noted in some of the reviews about that book, is that the whole book is talking about how Tolstoy can't be reduced to certain maxims or laws or rules because life is inherently too complex to be able to do that. And then at the end of the book, he goes and says, here are Tolstoy's rules for life. So it's kind of a contradiction with his premise to that right. thing. Now, I don't really care. I personally think it's an interesting way to try to re-engage with Tolstoy, right? It's clearly not meant to be, that particular section is not meant to be something that, Scott looks at and say, I've read the Tolstoy's Rules for Life, now I understand Tolstoy completely, right? That's not what that is. So the difference is, Gary Sloan Morrison is an extremely well-respected scholar who does real scholarship. Jash is somebody who makes Twitter posts, but he takes that same exact approach and says, I can summarize these books for you. I can pierce through the conspiracy veil and show you and teach you, and I have that knowledge, but if you have two brain cells to put together, you can see that he doesn't. you can see that these rules are, or whatever, this advice for the modern era, it is like you'd be better off listening to like the McElroys if you want to get advice for the modern era. It's just infuriating as all.
New lessons from old books. My lesson is, don't wait for things. Don't procrastinate. Go after your goal. Thank you. That's some forgotten knowledge there.
I think my challenge to Josh is I don't think you've read that many books.
No, and you...
I'm really not convinced that you've read a novel by any of the people that you're citing.
No, I believe that he's read a couple of these novels, and that's because... he's clearly read Camille Paglia, and that's, or Paglia, I don't know how you pronounce her name. And that's, you can tell because he's really trying to summarize this book. If you go to chapter three, let me introduce chapter three to you, which is called The Terrible.
I don't think he's read it. I think he is a first and last paragraph of each chapter kind of grad student.
I think this one makes him mad, so he keeps reading it. And I think that's mainly what drives him.
Okay. It's a hate read?
Not a hate read, just because, like, the person, in that way that, like, reactionaries will, like, write content that they get mad about and their friends get mad about with them, and, like, that kind of,
sure,
like, that's
sure.
the whole reason they're writing. I think that's what's going on here.
Yeah, it basically is.
Let me set the scene for you. So this is Camille Paglia's sexual persona. The chapter is titled, this is from chapter three, still from the human nature part, The Terrible Gulf Between Male and Female Nature. You can tell this one's going to be a banger. It is futile to talk of human nature without exploring the differences between male and female nature. Humankind is a childish liberal fantasy. There is mankind, there is womankind, and there's nothing else. You really know what this chapter is going to be about with that intro. And then he says, the best thinker on this topic is Camille Paglia. In the sense that this is an extremely stupid topic, I have no doubt about that sentence. I'm sure that's probably true. So, quoting from Paglia, sexual physiology sets the pattern for our experience of the world. You can tell this one's going to be a banger. This is Jash writing, the man's penis underlines linearity, focus, aim, directedness. Men are goal-oriented animals, and their goals make the world binary. Success and failure. If you want food, you either get fed or you starve. If you want to win an Olympic medal, you're either on the podium or you're not. The male world is either or, the female world is not. That's true in men and women sports. If you want food, you either get fed or you starve. No, that's the whole reason we've set up civilization is so that you can... Oh, that we can, I think that what he means is hunter. I don't even understand what he means. If you want food, you either get fed or you starve. Yeah, I guess that's...
Dude, wait till he finds out about, like, Uber Eats.
I guess in the sense that either you can eat or you cannot eat. That's a true statement. That's true. It's because of the penis that men have first, second, and third place, and women have first, second, and third place.
No, men only have first place, Cameron. We have three first places, actually. Right.
This is because nature, Paglia argues, forces females to make peace with hidden genitals, dash, what makes them comfortable with greater subjectivity. Okay. Paglia's argument is that your sexual organs determine your existential disposition. Note how the ultimate female book written by women for other women only is called 50 Shades of Grey. Coincidence? I'm sorry, you think 50 Shades of Grey is the ultimate female book?
That's incredible.
This is a great way to literally tell us all that you've never talked to a single woman even once in your life, because you know that the ultimate female book is a YA novel that I've never heard of, but has like spawned Tumblr dramas that to end the world.
I do like that I'm not going to be the only one to point this out. Probably other people have. I don't like to engage with this much content. Usually, it makes me rage click off of it too quick. But just the conception of what a woman wants, just in general, is being fabricated by these people that I'm not, like you said, I'm not really convinced that they've seen a woman, talk to one, acknowledged one, or rather been acknowledged by one.
Yeah.
And I think women are right for that. I think that's okay.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating.
Oh, here, this you're going to love this next section. Note how as more women entered academia in the past century, it became subjective. Mm. That is, feminine. Relativism came rushing in. Relativism, that's another one they hate. Relativism. Postmodernism,
yeah, they love relativism,
becomes the dominant academic lens. That's
is it defined? Is postmodernism defined?
Nope. You know, for sure, you know.
Oh,
it's not.
So close. Thank you for playing. I knew it wasn't.
The binary of right and wrong was thrown out as regressive. The question of whether 2 and 2 really adds up to 4 was mocked by George Orwell in 1984, Bell.
Oh. Do you think the 2 plus 2 equals 4 question has been raised in literature prior to this? Perhaps in literature that's also cited, thus proving that you have not read such literature?
You might think.
That's weird. That's weird.
1984 as the...
It's not going to be good when like their suspicious reading goes to 1984 first.
Yeah, I know. This man has never, I'm not confident he's ever approached academia in any meaningful form, because have you ever read old academic work? I am certain he's never read this, but I'm certain he like loves the idea of it, is the Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire. I don't remember if that's the exact title, by Edward Gibbon. Like, Gibbon's work is integral to how we talk about the Roman Empire today. I'm not saying it's accepted. I'm just saying that it's like...
He might have something on that in here, actually. You've fallen right into his trap, Cameron.
that makes sense. I feel like he's a Gibbon guy. And you know, I don't entirely dislike Gibbon. I think it's fine. I think there are serious criticisms. And there are many more modern historians who have done good reevaluations of that work. Gibbon's writing is not subjective. Like, it wasn't like entirely, you know, like it was in the between, but he would definitely editorialize. He'd do some. I remember this one line of, what was it, from talking about, this is the Byzantine era, of like, oh, I think Constantine put in place this thing where like he split up the remaining Roman Empire into two halves, and then each side had two Caesars or two Augustuses, whatever. And then he's like, it was an all too logical system and it caused endless conflict. And like, that's a small thing. I didn't mind it. I actually quite like that line. But like, lines like that, he's like constantly throwing in small editorializations like that. So yeah. It's like, it's not that, if you read any old academic work, you can see a lot of stuff like this.
Well, also, he's talking about Nietzsche as if that's objective. Right? Like, it's not, like, theory is not. So what are you left with?
Well, because his whole worldview is that there is an objective view of the world, and the objective view of the world is the people that he agrees with, or at the very least, thinks he agrees with.
Sure.
Yeah. So first of all, citation needed in any of this. Like, this is what men and women are like. Well, because of the penis, this, because of the vagina, that. I like it that he can't even say he can't even say vagina. He says the man's penis and then talks about hidden genitals of like I didn't even notice this. The man's penis versus females have hidden genital. It's like,
yes,
it's like looking at animals in a, like, to say nothing of like how like violently and horribly like transphobic this worldview is. Like, this is such a, like, I think in the 1950s, if you expressed this to someone, they'd be like, oh, that's a little strong there, buddy.
I think maybe he is curious what's there. I don't know, it's possible.
Here's the best I think this is the best subheading from this chapter. The subheading is civilization is male, nature is female. And the entirety of this section is civilization is a male project to tame and channel the chaotic energies of nature. No quote. That's it. That's the whole section.
Right. Right.
That's awesome.
I think, yeah, I love the type of writing that is, like we've been saying, like the Twitter writing, which is only meant to generate outrage, basically. That's awesome.
Yep. Yeah, that's... Yeah, this chapter is significantly longer than all the other ones I'm seeing. I think it's interesting that this method of having actual subheadings and a chapter being more than a page and a half long is carried through for at least the first couple of chapters. I don't know. Looks like they give it up by chapter. Jash gives that format up by chapter four, but he tried. He tried.
Yeah, I also like that some of them are not lessons from books. Some of them are just like just headings with some thoughts that he has.
Oh, this is so good. Is there any chapters that you... I've got some more chapters I wanted to cover. Is there anywhere else? I'm gonna give it to you. Is there anyone you want to cover?
I have really no skin in the game here. I like why when he talks about why aristocracy beats democracy.
Yeah. Right,
as his sort of appeal to authority, he talks about Elon Musk.
That's awesome.
And why you should read certain books, you know, that he likes or recommends, as if that's sort of the ultimate authority. That's amazing.
That's so cool. That's
it's really good.
Oh, yeah. Here's a good one. This is chapter 13 from part two, which I think is Fighting the Modern World. This one's titled Feminism's Five Major Mistakes.
What'd they get wrong?
Let's see. Oh, God, this one's awesome. So the book they're covering this one is What's Wrong with the World by G.K. Chesterton, which was written in 1910.
Would you call that an old book?
That is an old book. Let's see. Let's find out what.
Slight nitpick. Yeah. Is when you said old books.
Right.
I kind of thought like we were doing like 19th century golden age, maybe even earlier. And then you get into like 20th century. Like, it's old, I
old
guess.
Books, the 1980s.
But... Yeah, well, right. Yeah, there's several essays that he picks that are from like the 70s and 80s, and I'm like, it's not old, nor is it a book, but all right. Nor do you understand it, but sure, go ahead.
Look, that's a really high bar for him to... I mean, as he said, it's only good if it survives, so he probably...
That is true.
Given that I'm...
You are kind of limited by that.
Right. Okay, let's see. Feminism is not a law of nature. It's not a scientific fact. It's a political ideology. I don't think anyone has ever said it's anything else. The pro-feminist arguments are just that, arguments. They can be challenged, attacked, and refuted. Okay? That's what G.K. Chesterton did more than 100 years ago in his 1910 book, What's Wrong with the World? We will explore his arguments here. All right, let's see. What's feminism's first mistake? In traditional societies, women weren't denied work. They were spared work. The feminist conception of working is absurdly romantic. What? The reality is that work drains your time, energy, and your very spirit. Yeah, talk to any woman you know with a job. That's, they know. Chesterton writes that the traditional arrangement of keeping women out of offices and factories protect them from harassing industrial demands. What if we just didn't have those harassing industrial demands? That's a thought. Women were shielded from the direct cruelty of competitive or bureaucratic toil. Until very recently in human history, work meant pollution, odors, physical pain, headaches, and increased risk of death. The inverse thought of that is, until very recently in human history, that was not necessarily what toil was like. It was tough. I would say pollution, odors... why pollution, odors, and headaches? That's a weird one, but like that's a fairly modern thing.
He really doesn't like industrial capitalism.
Yeah,
but he can't think deep enough to probe that.
Right,
he's like, oh, why do buildings look ugly now? Well, I don't know, maybe our developers trying to build them as quickly and cheaply as possible, and they all look like, you know, They make brutalist buildings look good. You know, this is exactly his problem, and he can't identify it. But he'll vamp for like 200 pages trying to.
Right.
Oh, maybe it's the fact that women are working. That's the issue.
They don't think that is the
issue. Not the fact that we're all being poisoned at our jobs.
The real issue is that only the men should be being poisoned. That's exactly. So true, Josh. I think also,
women, yeah, he's like, yeah, women should go back to doing things that are not taxing on them, like having babies. That would be good. That's his point.
That's awesome. Yeah. Also, in traditional,
it will be his point. I saw some thread about that yesterday.
Oh, that's good. It's also telling that he cites traditional societies without saying what traditional societies, because you know he does not know any traditional societies. He's thinking of wealthy. Europeans in certain eras, which is even...
That's what I'm saying. Statistically, he wouldn't have been a wealthy European.
Yeah, women have always worked. Either you're in a society where the distribution of labor is different, and this just point doesn't even make sense, or you're in probably the societies he's thinking of, which I have to imagine is like Victorian England is his ideal era. Women did work. It was poor women who worked, and then if you had the money, you didn't. If you needed money, you've always had to work. Like, that's... That's the actual historical reality.
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's true. Well, what if we just...
Not in the books I'm reading.
That's true. It's not in his traditional societies, for sure.
We must be talking about different traditional societies.
Right. So I don't know what the mistake is here. I guess the mistake is that women work now. He's phrasing it in a weird way, like it's the 1960s, like... Women are entering the workforce. What do we think about that? let's see. Okay, so there's no real mistake there. Just something that makes him mad. Feminism. Second mistake.
Well,
housework.
It's not a surprise to me that sort of logic applies to him. That's sort of, oh, well, we're doing this for you. Really, it's for your benefit.
Yeah.
That we're depriving you of rights. Because, I mean, of course, somebody who would buy into an aristocracy would buy into that sort of logic. Right.
Hold on. Feminism, second mistake. Housework isn't narrower than real work. It's broader. The feminists have it backwards. They argue that real work outside home is creative and empowering, while housework is repetitive drudgery. So TLDR, work is bad. He really seems to hate work. Work sucks, I know. But then it's really cool to be a housewife instead.
I'm begging Josh to just do dishes for like a week. Yeah. It sucks. It sucks. There's always dishes. Where do they come from?
Yeah, what do you think this man, do you think he's in a relationship, like, is clearly if he's in a relationship, no. It's like someone needs to do all the dish, like, stuff at home, and he clearly is not. I don't think he's ever even looked at a woman. What do you think his home life is like? If he's, like, arguing that if housework is, like, actually really opening to your mind and work is tough, because his work of writing tweets is really tough, what is his home like? How full is that sink?
I don't know, I just like the borderline, like he's almost does like a Tolstoyan thing.
Yeah.
You know, where like, oh, this is fulfilling to just be happy with where you are. But see, that's the difference. Tolstoy is kind of like a be happy with where you are, you know, make the most of this, you know, whatever. If it's housework, try to enjoy it, whatever. This is just so, I don't know. You can't really be happy with housework because you have to go do your sort of Nietzschean will to power thing. And you have to get your gold medal because either you eat or you don't.
Right.
And I don't know.
Yeah, it's good. Let's see. Feminism's third mistake.
I'm just left not understanding the lessons, I guess.
There are no lessons here. The mistake is feminism thinks that being forced to be a housewife is tough. sorry, women. G.K. Chesterton in 1910 said that's not true. let's see. Third mistake. Oh, here we go. This one's awesome. Not awesome. I mean that in the inverse sense. Women were correctly kept out of politics because abstract thinking is difficult, if not impossible, for them.
Jesus. Dude. wow.
Oh.
Imagine just lapping that up with not even a little bit of, I can't. I love to see where the skepticism is so lost.
Yeah.
Oh, G.K. Chesterton said it, so I should believe it.
Right.
Whereas, we should be skeptical of other things, but not that.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
What is... Okay, yeah, that's the whole idea, is just that women can't govern. That's the mistake, is that feminism said women can, in fact, govern. All right.
Right.
Let's see. Feminism, fourth mistake. Offices are less free than homes, not more. So that's the housework thing again.
Okay.
Feminism's fifth mistake. Civilization cannot do without generalist people and generalist tools. What? Chesterton used the example of tools like fire and sticks to show why generalists matter. Okay, well, the fire is the same. Women have handled the generalist mantle since the beginning of history until feminism started making the absurd demands of them. What? Chesterton writes, I do not deny that women have been wronged or even tortured, but I doubt if they were ever tortured so much as they are tortured now by the absurd modern attempt to make them domestic empresses and competitive clerks at the same time. What does he mean by gen? So all men are specialists, all women are generalists. Is that the point?
Yeah, it's like he's building, like, I don't know, it's crazy. Like the, I don't know, I guess he thinks of different attributes, like he's like a Crusader Kings player.
Yeah, I'm pretty certain every society has been had to be generalist since the start. Like that, you didn't have specialization because you, for the most part, till later on, societies had like enough people to be specialized. You had to kind of wear a lot of hats. In terms that he might understand, early human culture is like a startup. You can't. There's one of my favorite chapters in here. I have to admit is when he quotes The Elements of Style by E.B. Strunk. And if you're not familiar, I assume you are familiar. But the Elements of Clear Writing by E.B. Strunk is like just a guide. Like, here's how you write with more clarity.
Oh. Yeah.
And
I remember reading, skipping over this chapter.
Yeah. And it's like, it's still a good book. I really like it. Like, it's still the, that book is still the basis of a lot of how, a lot of the theory and how AP puts together its style guide. And I think they do that correctly. I think it's a lot of really good advice in there. However, what we get here is a little different. The chapter is titled Nine Writing Tips from the Highest Selling Writing Guide. And first of all, there's not actually nine tips in here. It's like, I mean, maybe there are, but there are only four subheadings.
Well, I thought good books survive because of the lessons they have to teach us, not because of their gross total sales.
That's true.
But what do I know?
The entirety of this chapter is almost the entirety of this chapter is quoted material. There's almost each, like, these subheadings, there is no analysis. It's just quotes. Not even, you know, no page numbers, nothing. And here's the introduction. This is a banger. Napoleon Bonaparte once said, Napoleon Bonaparte once said the nobility could have kept their heads in the French Revolution if they'd mastered the writing desk. What the fuck?
Okay.
He meant that they should have learned to manipulate public perception via words. It's really telling that this is like, he's like, totalitarianism is bad, but elites propagandizing to us is good. It tells you where he thinks.
Well, it's good if they're like aristocrats.
Yeah, I guess so.
But, you know, if you're like a Stalinist, then no.
In the interest of keeping heads and influencing men when necessary, here are the best tips from The Elements of Style. It's the highest selling writing guide of all time. This dude clearly just Googled that and was like, oh, this is interesting. Make clear assertions. Yeah, avoid tame, colorless, hesitating, non-committal language. Thanks. Mm. That's great. That's good.
I'll get right on that.
I love these subheadings. Okay, so make clear assertions. Sure. Don't just negate, affirm. Okay. Eliminate everything unnecessary. Great. All those chapters, all those subheadings are just followed by quotes with no analysis. And then the fourth subheading is Michelangelo. Oh, wait, hold on.
What about Michelangelo?
Wait, hold on. Oh, my God. Wait. Okay, so there's the quote. Every block of stone has a statue inside of it and is the task of the sculptor to discover it. I don't know why you quoted that. That's just like putting a little flavor text on it, putting a fine little pin on an actual point. That's not point in and of itself. Sentences with shared structures are rhythmic. Rhythmic sentences are easier to absorb and remember. William Strunk expressed coordinate ideas in similar form. Similar form create rhythm, which makes your ideas stickier. Okay, first of all, that's the wrong lesson to take away from there, because you actually you want to vary your sentences. That's actually because if you keep them in similar form, that's when people start losing interest because they're reading the same thing over and the same at the same intervals and the same time. At the same intervals and the same time, I start talking about the same ideas. It becomes easier to ignore me. That's why I can't speak to the style guide, but almost every other writing education you're going to get is going to tell you to vary your sentences. This is not the same. Express coordinate ideas in similar form is a different idea from what he's saying. Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, yeah. Just don't think too hard about it, maybe.
Vagueness is evil, and it poisons not just prose, but life, too. That's awesome. Being vague is in fact, evil. Nothing can be small in this man's world. Everything has to be a battle of good and evil. You can't just... Vagueness can't just be bad writing. Vagueness is the great societal evil destroying Western civilization.
Yeah, that's what I... That's true. Well, because if you're vague, are you also relative?
Right.
That's the question that nobody asks.
That's a great question. That's the question we should be asking.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah, there's so many more. Every chapter is just as easy. Chapter 39, 10 Thoughts on Beauty from Jordan Peterson. He's really obsessed with beauty, but never talking about what is beautiful, just like the idea of it. Beauty is terrifying to people because it highlights the ugly. He can't even like things. He's still got to be mad about something. This must be exhausting. You can't just be like, this is nice. I like looking at this tree. It's like... looking at something that he finds pleasing reminds him of something he hates. What an exhausting way to live.
Yeah, basically.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, I don't think that's what beauty's supposed to do.
Modern architecture saves costs but destroys the soul. This is why this version of like ideology is incoherent to me, because there's like, I don't know why modern architecture is such a big... I mean, you know, I get it. I'm in the process of moving to like an old neighborhood now because I like the fact that the houses are older and it's nicer and I can walk to the store to buy my groceries. I'm sure that would, I feel like the 15-minute city idea would make him go into a rage, but that beside the point.
Mm-hmm.
Guys like him are always posting like old cathedrals. I'm like, why don't we do stuff like this anymore? Brother, because you know how they did that? Because they taxed the shit. Like, you had a hegemon who taxed the living fuck out of his populace for like 300 years, and they never even finished half of those things. You would hate that. It happened.
Also, free labor.
Yeah, and it happened because they lived in fundamentally different societies. And now you have to pay all those workers, and I'm sure you'd love to not work it because you imagine that you would be in, of course, the class of people who get to do all the taxing. But like, you would hate the process of how you would actually go about nicer and more expensive architecture. Like,
also, please nobody tell them that Freemasons were involved.
Right. they're really mad at stuff. They're like, can you believe the liberals or the woke DEI gave us modern architecture instead of the the market system that you champion everywhere else?
I don't believe it. I don't believe it.
I don't know. This man is, I don't even know what to say. Oh, wait, chapter 47 is sexual personae again. It's back to back. We're not even doing new. Oh my God.
Well, some old books, some books that aren't quite old to us, but
wait, hold,
you know,
I think we're going too long. Do you want to, I'm just going to go through the last couple of chapters. I'm just going to read the titles to you.
Please.
So this is part Speed four round. Called the Ubermensch Manual.
Okay. I'm going to read that later.
All right. The first chapter is how to become a man of history. All right.
Need that.
That's
okay.
Nietzsche, of course. 49 is how to be honorable.
Okay. That's good.
Chapter 50 is when high IQ becomes a problem.
Yeah, and is that talking about anything, or is that just his
thoughts?
Let's
see. The ultimate conclusion is life does not exist to serve the brain, but brain exists to serve life.
Okay, sure. Don't know what that means, but all right, that's fine.
I love that he doesn't even cite anyone. He's just like, British novelist explains in the Aristos, okay? And then he goes on to talk about G.K. Chesterton again, and then quotes two Twitter friends and Nietzsche. This man's running out of ideas. This one, he didn't even add anything. This is just a Twitter thread. He's
who needs a Lyceum when you have Twitter?
Yeah, that's right. 51, inside Napoleon's mind.
All right, sure. Let's bash like modern approaches, but then go with psychoanalysis. All right, fine.
All right, this is 5 pages, which is kind of a tight, like that's a blockbuster for how long these chapters are for him.
For real.
The strange advantages of shooting your own leg.
All right. I feel like I'm about to take that advice.
anal behaviors look stupid, inefficient, or merely decorative are actually better explained through the handicap principle. By handicapping oneself, an animal sends a reliable signal about its abundant power, strength, and sincerity. I don't... Okay, sure.
This is an excuse for why they don't talk to women. It's a power move, actually. I'm handicapping myself.
Actually, all the flies on the billion plates in my sink are me handicapping myself to show I'm such an alpha until I marry someone who will do all of this for me. Let's see, 53, white.
It's just going to be really difficult to get up and build my cathedral with my broken legs.
53, Why Heroes Matter. Again, not about a book. 54, The Hell of Bad Habits. The Laws of Habit.
53 is just, he really wants to go into a little Marvel movie discourse.
wait, hold on. So, Mal, okay, so he's talking about T.E. Lawrence and Andre.
We should have done this episode for April Fool's.
Oh, fuck, we should have. All right, that would have been so good. Hold on, sorry. The conclusion of that chapter is, often the difference between a successful person and failure is not one has better ideas or abilities, but has the courage to act on one's ideas or to take a calculated risk and to act. Bet on your ideas. Take calculated risks. Act. You didn't need to write a whole chapter. You could just say that. The nerd jock dichotomy is false. Great men are often bored men. I mean, these are just banger titles. These are all the anti-stoic manifesto. And there's.
I thought they were into stoicism, though.
He's really mad about nihilism. That's awesome.
Okay.
I don't know why he's so mad about nihilism.
Well, you can't. I think you can't eat if you don't believe in anything. Probably. You can't place on the podium for your medal if you don't believe in anything.
You make a good point.
Which by extension means you can't eat and build cathedrals.
That's right. Those are the most important things. 62 is Joe Rogan's favorite book. That's awesome.
Let's go. Again, not the appeal to authority he thinks it is.
Yeah. Hold on. I'm just scared. The very last chapter in this book is called H.P. Lovecraft Seeks the Higher Life. Okay, I'm a big Lovecraft guy. I acknowledge his shortcomings and racism. I grew up on H.P. Lovecraft, so I'm gonna scan this and see what his takeaway is, because I love Lovecraft. You shouldn't really have takeaways from him. Like, he's got.
Maybe we should invite him to like a Call of Cthulhu.
Oh, that'd be good. Well, that he does. H.P. Lovecraft, the famous horrorist who wrote The Call of Cthulhu, comes across as a soulful aristocrat in his obscure essays and personal letters. You know he calls him a soulful aristocrat because H.P. Lovecraft was a virulent racist and an incel.
Yeah.
He saw this and he's like...
Soulful is a good word.
Right. He read that and he was like, man of culture, someone else. Which is weird because H.P. Lovecraft did get married and move to New York, but he was like too afraid to go outside. So then he got divorced and moved back to Rhode Island. Tale as old as Rhode Island.
Basically.
H.P. Lovecraft attacks mass democracy, lays out a critique of modern priorities, and describes what society he believes society must aim at. I should emphasize that even for his time, people thought H.P. Lovecraft was like a weird racist.
Right. I think you're like, there's no favors being done by picking obscure letters of these people.
Right.
Because they're not good. There's probably a reason that they're still obscure.
Let's see. Oh, this whole thing is just about an argument for aristocracy. A great society can only be built when the most gifted contribute, and for their contribution, the aristocrats must be rewarded. You could tell this man has definitely read Tolstoy, because that's what Tolstoy thinks about the aristocracy, very famously in War and Peace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The difference...
That's what I'm saying. Like, they all believe that they are the smart, gifted, chosen men that will propel society forward.
Yeah.
When, like... No, you just write on Twitter.
That's what you do. Here we go. H.P. Lovecraft explains the difference between real and fake aristocrats. So don't worry. If aristocrats do things that I don't like, they're the fake ones. Only the real ones are that. So this...
It's such a romanticized idea of what being an aristocrat was like.
I know. If he's ever read any Tolstoy, he didn't comprehend a single word of it.
No.
Let's see. Okay, his ultimate. This is the very last paragraph in the book. This entire chapter about H.P. Lovecraft arguing for an aristocracy, which I gotta say, there's a lot of things you shouldn't take H.P. Lovecraft's advice on. One of the things that you should least take his advice on is forms of governance. Civilization should be set up for the production of beauty and greatness. We advocate the preservation of conditions favorable to the growth of beautiful things, imposing palaces, beautiful cities, elegant literature, reposeful art and music, and a physically select human type. I love that we end on eugenics. That's great. There's no better way.
Yep. I also like that in his mind, like, beauty is the process of some, I say mechanical production, but some sort of set of situations that can be replicated in order to produce it.
Yeah.
Which is fundamentally not what most of the people that he's citing think.
Right. Well,
so real king way to end that one.
Yeah. I mean, you know, of course, art is the, you know, terrible duty of man. But that means that not everyone can do art. Only the supremely talented can do art. And only if they can catch the eye of the right kind of aristocrat. And of course, every other type of art produced by humans doesn't even really deserve the name, because it's not getting to the highness of the soul, whatever that means. You can't.
It has to be produced by aristocrats who have all shot themselves in the
right
legs.
It, everything has to be like photorealistic. It has to be super highly technical. You know, a self-portrait that's not entirely literal. You get abstract. That's a little weird and commie. Better get rid of that, I would have to imagine.
Yeah.
Just awesome.
Just awesome stuff.
Just, yeah, that's just A+. See me after class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No notes. No notes.
Anyways, that's there's a lot more, but I promise you there's not that much more. That's
there's a lot more words. There's not much more there.
Yeah. Like I said, if I wrote this in 3 months, I would be so embarrassed I'd never show my face again, but it took this man 3 years.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair, writing 17,000 tweets is really hard.
Yeah. I mean, all the life and fate posts we've been writing, I feel that.
Right.
I feel that. My 17,000 chapters.
Jesus Christ. I think we got a petition to change his name because I feel like you only get to call yourself a book guy on Twitter or any social media if you talk about books. You have to, like, at least every 10 tweets has to at least have one about a book, which he does not currently meet.
No, I don't think so. It's like, here's an obscure letter I found by somebody.
Right.
Okay. That's okay.
Yeah. So yeah, that's Jash. That's Jash Delani. Is I think there's only man. I think it's awesome that he's scrolling back through his Twitter page. You can tell which ones are the authors he's actually read because he tweets about like Camille Paglia and George Orwell, and those are the ones that he keeps referencing in his own book because I presume they're the only ones he's actually read, so they're the only ones he can actually think back to reference.
But the thing is, he doesn't really engage with their ideas either. It's just there's more quotes from them. But that's not an engagement. So, you know.
We all know Elon, sorry, from his Twitter, we all know Elon Musk is the greatest entrepreneur on Earth. What does he do different? Brother, if you think that he's still the greatest entrepreneur on Earth after this last year, economically speaking, I don't know what to tell you, but you're not going to make it.
Yeah.
I don't
think
there's any help for you, to be honest.
I don't know.
Anyway.
You don't think that the giant X sign on top of the building was beauty? So anyways, I think this episode is kind of unofficially titled Stop Reading.
Stop. I will either, one of two ways, either we should all stop reading, literacy was a mistake, and or Jash, I guess that we tell Jash to stop reading, but I don't think he started in the first place, so I guess that wouldn't change anything about what he does.
Fundamentally, no. Fundamentally, no.
All right. In the same way that Jash does not have a single real actionable outcome from his book, I think that's also how we should leave this episode, other than, you know, when you see someone like that, feel free to make fun of them. There's no reason to take them seriously.
Yeah. I have no calls to action for the end of the episode in true Jash spirit, I think. You know where to find us if you want to find us.
You know.
In Magnitogorsk,
yeah. You can find the links down to the beautiful page of Visit Magnitogorsk, where you can buy all-inclusive trips to the great city. most of them do require working in a factory to pay off some of that, but that's part of the experience.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what are you going
to
do?
All right. let's play this one out.
Do we need to do a script, or we're just... That's it.
That's it. I don't think we need to do an outro on this one.
I don't think so either.
Thank you to all of our subscribers who pay us money every month, and we're sorry that you paid money for this.
Listen, your money in some way helped us get this book from Jash and Gumroad.
Don't tell them that. They're going to stop funding us.
Yeah. You are now personally responsible in some part for this.
Each of you put in a few pennies. All right, let's stop talking before we incriminate ourselves more.